Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Pavel Butorin, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. And this episode, as Belarus turns to international organizations for help amidst an escalating financial crisis, we go to the capital Minsk and speak to some of its citizens about their economic troubles.
We are scared because we don't know how we are going to live. We have no idea what's going to happen now.
Jan Maksymiuk of our Belarus service will join me in the Blender studios to provide his insight on the unfolding economic crisis.
The underlying reason for Belarus' dire straits is the lack of economic modernization and reforms in line with what was undertaken in the past by other post-communist countries in the region.
Michael McFaul, U.S. President Barack Obama's top advisor on Russia and probably America's next ambassador to Moscow, gives his take on the latest session of a high-ranking U.S.-Russia dialogue on human rights in Washington earlier this month.
A healthy media and an independent media is a necessary, you know, and maybe one of the most effective tools for reducing corruption, for exposing corruption within the government. There obviously are many things a Russian government could do if they were serious about this.
And we talked to a young Uzbek taxi driver in Chicago who is gaining popularity by singing to his customers in his native language.
They asked me, hey, I gotta have this music. What language is that? And then I proudly said, Uzbek.
We begin with Belarus, where its citizens are struggling to make ends meet amid a deepening financial crisis that has sent consumer prices soaring. While their government scrambles to secure a bailout loan, Belarusians are eyeing their future with growing anxiety. This is a report filed by Halina Abakunchik and Claire Big, narrated by Bogdan Andrusishin.
There was a time when Ivan Antanyuk enjoyed grocery shopping. Fresh fruits and vegetables, meat, cold cuts, cheese, fish, and the occasional sweet treat were once staples in his shopping basket. Today, buying groceries has become a frustrating chore for the retired army officer whose real income has shrunk more than twofold since a devastating financial crisis struck Belarus in March. Returning from a recent trip to his local store, the 81-year-old Minsk resident peered disapprovingly into his shopping bag.
Just the bare essentials: flour, cereals, oil, sugar, cheese, kefir, and milk. I didn't get any bread, potatoes, or vegetables. We rarely eat meat or sausages. It's very expensive.
Pensioners like Antanyuk are among the worst hit by the crisis, which has sent inflation soaring. To tackle the meltdown sparked by a rise in Russian energy prices and a lavish public spending campaign ahead of the December 19th presidential election, Belarus last month devalued the official rate of its ruble by 36%. Since the beginning of the year, it has lost more than half its value. Belarus's authoritarian president, Alexander Lukashenko, has also set aside his grievances against the West and asked the International Monetary Fund for a rescue loan. His traditional ally, Russia, has refused to grant Belarus a direct loan, instead offering a $3 billion rescue package to be issued by a regional grouping, the Eurasian Economic Community. While their government scrambles to secure a bailout, Belarusians have been hoarding basic foods and forming long lines at exchange points to convert some of their savings into foreign currency, in scenes reminiscent of the chaos that followed the Soviet Union's collapse 20 years ago. Consumer prices have spun out of control. According to official figures, prices for fruit leapt by a staggering 50% in May alone, while prices for tea rose by 46% and fuel prices by almost 20%. Antanyuk and his wife Svetlana now spend as much as two-thirds of their monthly income, which currently amounts to a combined $300, on food. They must also pay utility bills and buy costly medication for Svetlana. With the Belarusian ruble tumbling further every day, the Antanyuks, who rely solely on their pension for subsistence, are starting to panic.
Just look at the prices. It's a collapse, a catastrophe. But if you listen to state-controlled radio or television, everything is just fine. I don't know how we're supposed to live.
The couple's frugal lifestyle is a far cry from the comfortable existence they led as pensioners in Soviet times, which Antoniuk nostalgically refers to as the Golden Age. The couple had long dreamed of visiting Svetlana's native city of Tambov in Russia. This dream, like much else these days, is now out of their reach.
What holiday? I vacation in my room, my wife vacations in hers. And we call out to each other, "Are you still alive? I'm alive. Good, me too." What kind of a holiday can we talk about with our miserable income?
The Antoniuks worked hard all their lives and had been looking forward to retirement. The economic hardships that Belarus has endured since the breakup of the Soviet Union have forced them to lower their expectations. Today, the financial meltdown has shattered their last hopes for a peaceful retirement.
We're surviving. Surviving and living out our days. Even in my worst nightmares, I had never thought it would turn out this way. It's not just a collapse of the system. It's a catastrophe. Everybody can feel it.
Some 70 kilometers away, in the town of Maladechna, things are looking a little brighter for Volha Lagdinovich and her family. The mother of two and her husband, Jan, are well prepared for the crisis. Huge bags of pasta, rice, sugar, tea, and coffee clutter their flat, which they share with Volha's parents. Unlike Ivan Antoniuk and his wife, the Lagdinoviches own a small summer house with a vegetable patch that is proving a precious helping in reducing their grocery bills. They also rely heavily on financial support from their parents, who are still employed. The young couple has never had money to spare. Jan earns the equivalent of $250 a month as a worker in a local wood factory, while Volha brings in an additional $100 in child and maternity benefits. So far, they have managed to cut back only on non-essentials, such as bottled water or ice cream for the children. Thanks to their tight-knit family and their homegrown produce, they hope to weather the crisis without too many privations.
When people talk about this crisis Armageddon, I respond by recalling the period between 1996 and 1999 when, for example, my mother, who is a highly qualified engineer, earned just $30 a month.
But despite their resilience and their efforts to remain optimistic, the Lagdinoviches, like the vast majority of Belarusians, can't help eyeing the future with mounting anxiety.
We are scared because we don't know how we are going to live. We have no idea what's going to happen now.
This was a story written by Halina Abakunchik and Claire Big. This was a joint production by RFERL's Belarus Service and Central Newsroom. The story was narrated by Bogdan Andrusishin. Here to comment on the economic crisis unfolding in Belarus is my colleague, a journalist from our Belarusian service, Jan Maksymyuk. Jan, welcome to The Blender.
Hi.
We just heard a story illustrating the plight of regular shoppers in Minsk. The story was produced early this week, and perhaps you can bring us up to date about any recent developments in Belarus this week.
Yes, let's just make a small recapitulation of the problems that Lukashenko has had with public protests in Belarus recently. Well, on May 7, car drivers blocked the main thoroughfare in Minsk protesting gasoline price hikes. The authorities fined some participants in this protest action, but Lukashenko backed down on the following day by ordering to decrease the prices. Why? The main reason may be in the fact that the protest was very popular among Minsk residents, judging by the reactions of passersby. And people in the Belarusian capital are usually much better organized than in the provinces. So Lukashenko might not want to risk the escalation of gasoline protests, and he backed down, for the time being at least. One more interesting detail in this, the protest was organized by a public campaign against fuel price increases, which has been active for a year or so. The campaign is being conducted not by political opposition, but by public activists who do not raise political demands. It is apparently more difficult for the authorities to spot who is actually responsible for fomenting such non-political protests. Well, in the past, the authorities managed to isolate the political opposition from wider society and took it under strict control. In actual fact, most opposition leaders either are now in jail or have been intimidated to keep a low profile. Such economic protests as this one about gasoline poses a new challenge for Lukashenko. Then, on May 12 and 13, there were two protests of Belarusian drivers at border checkpoints with Poland. They were protesting the recently introduced tougher regulations on gasoline and other commodities that people in the borderland used to sell in Poland, taking advantage of the difference in prices in both countries. So, in other words, there were spontaneous protests among so-called shuttle traders, who usually visit Poland several times a week to earn their living. And we also had two flash mobs organized in Minsk through social networking websites. Hundreds of mostly young protesters who gathered in Minsk were chased by police officers who also cordoned off a central square and adjacent streets. Lukashenko, judging by this, is obviously afraid of letting people self-organize in such a way. Even if they don't put forward political demands, he is clearly sensing a risk to his rule in such actions. People who now demand from him to deliver on his economic promises may also want to begin demanding his ouster if he fails to deliver.
If we could look back, in his April address to Parliament, Lukashenko was talking about a hard currency deficit and how Belarus's export revenues did not cover its internal demand for hard currencies, and he cited rising energy prices as a possible cause. So do independent analysts agree with the government's take on this? Why is this happening right now?
Well, why is this happening? There are two direct reasons for Lukashenko's economic and financial problems. First, Russia has begun to phase out lavish oil and gas subsidies that allowed him to keep the Belarusian economy afloat without undertaking any serious structural reforms. And Russia deprived Lukashenko of some other essential revenues, for example, of tax on used motor vehicles bought abroad and shipped into Belarus. This tax is now paid to the budget of the customs union of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. We are speaking here about essential revenues, measured in billions of dollars rather than millions. And second, Lukashenko obviously overspent during his populist campaign in the run-up to the December presidential election by rising wages and pensions. That triggered inflation, depleted the country's foreign currency reserves, and caused other unpleasant phenomena in Belarus, like long lines before currency exchange booths or a shop panic. People began to take their savings out of banks and buy consumer products or even foodstuffs for fear of devaluation. But, of course, the underlying reason for Belarus' dire straits is the lack of economic modernization and reforms in line what was undertaken in the past by other post-communist countries in the region. This is what analysts and commentators on the Belarusian situation say. The government, of course, does not explain the current problems in this way. It prefers to blame profiteers or appeal to people not to panic and buy less sugar, meat or cheese.
So what are Lukashenko's options now?
Well, Eurasian Economic Community promised Lukashenko 3 billion.
And that's a union that is led by Russia?
Yes, 3 billion within the next 4 years, on condition of undertaking some unspecific reforms. Well, this is not the sum that may improve Belarus' situation considerably. Lukashenko needs much more. Some time ago, China promised him $10 billion. But, as it turned out later, this is not the money that he can use according to his own will. The promised Chinese credits are tied to different Belarusian-Chinese projects connected with trade and industry. And these projects are, you know, intended to promote the Chinese economy rather than the Belarusian one. So this is why Minsk recently asked the IMF for $8 billion. If the IMF refuses to give this credit, Belarus may find itself in real troubles indeed.
You mentioned the IMF, but does the IMF loan come with any preconditions, any call for any structural reforms?
Well, the IMF said that it will need economic reforms. It will not put any political conditions on Lukashenko's regime, but it will demand radical economic reforms, and that will be the precondition.
Speaking of Lukashenko's political system, what are implications of this essentially economic meltdown for his grip on the country, for his political rule?
Well, many suppose that Lukashenko will be reluctant to allow radical structural reforms in his Soviet model economy. He is afraid of radical economic liberalization that may diminish his grip on the country. So this crisis may imply that he will put for sale some important state-owned assets. He recently suggested that he is willing to sell Belaruskali, a giant state concern producing potash fertilizers. Well, in my opinion, he will try to buy time by selling family jewels. But he is unlikely to make this sale a transparent and civilized privatization process in which everyone will have the same chances to make a bid. It's hard to predict right now whether he can buy time without dismantling some elements of his political system. Much will depend on how Belarusians will behave during the crisis and whether he will be able to stifle their discontent in face of economic hardships, because these hardships will only grow in the future.
Well, thank you, Jan. This was certainly very educational. This was Jan Maksymiuk of RFERL's Belarus service. Up next, Michael McFaul, a senior advisor to President Obama for Russian and Eurasian Affairs, shares his thoughts on the U.S.-Russia dialogue on human rights.
С вами Радио Свобода.
Радио Фарда Кушника.
Айче Радио Европа.
Машал Радио.
Азатыч Радиосы.
Азатитюн КТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
The latest session of a high-ranking U.S.-Russia dialogue on human rights included frank exchanges on press freedom and corruption, according to Michael McFaul, senior director of Russia and Eurasia Affairs on the U.S. President's National Security Council, the civil society working group under the U.S.-Russia Bilateral Presidential Commission, was established 2 years ago as part of the reset in U.S.-Russia relations. McFaul, who will reportedly be nominated by President Barack Obama to be America's next ambassador to Russia, holds the chair for the U.S. side. His Russian counterpart is Vladislav Surkov, the Kremlin's top ideologist. How do these working groups help improve the human rights situation in Russia? Our chief Washington editor, Christian Karl, spoke to Michael McFaul about the latest session of this working group.
Tell us a little bit about the purpose of the civil society working group in general. What is it supposed to achieve?
Well, let me start with a little history. When the Bilateral Presidential Commission was established in President Obama's first trip to Russia in the summer of 2009, we had a goal to establish a relationship with Russia along many dimensions and not just have it limited to issues like arms control. And it was our view that having a dialogue about civil society should be part of this commission as well. And in particular, for this working group, we wanted to discuss how the interaction between civil society and government can lead to better public policy. We had four subgroups, one on child protection, one on migration, one on prison reform, and one on anti-corruption efforts. And they reported out their work last week to the full plenary session of this working group.
And what were the results? For example, on prison reform, what came out in their accounting?
There was a discussion of particularly egregious violations of human rights of people. We had a very long discussion of the Magnitsky case with civil society representatives at the meeting, in particular asking the toughest questions of all to Mr. Surkov and other representatives of the Russian government. There was general consensus in the room on the Russian side that what happened to Mr. Magnitsky was a tragedy. Nobody's defending what happened to him. And they explained the new laws that were put in place as a result of that. I think that, you know, others pushed back on that to say, well, you know, it's one thing to have new laws, but the people that were responsible for this crime have not, you know, been prosecuted. And, you know, there was a pretty healthy exchange about that. And a pretty healthy disagreement about the facts of that particular case.
Also among the Russians, you seem to be saying?
Yes.
Now, what about the corruption issue? It's a deeply entrenched phenomenon in Russia today. Do you really see this dialogue as an expression of a government will to do something about this? I mean, it seems to be such an entrenched part of also the government sphere in Russia.
I guess I'd put it this way. I mean, nobody in this working group or the sub-working group that works on these issues specifically, you know, is defending corruption, right? It's one of those issues where everybody's on the same side of the divide in terms of
the diagnostics. It's when the prescriptions come in that there are differences of opinion and what to do. We have been leaning heavily to talk about ways of open government initiatives. By the way, this is something President Obama himself, for our government, has been quite engaged in. So, you know, we were sharing those set of experiences of what we've done to expand that. But we also had a pretty candid discussion and had representatives from Transparency International there to talk about the role that civil society can and should play to fight corruption and the role that the media must play to fight corruption. And that, you know, a healthy media and an independent media is a necessary, you know, and maybe one of the most effective tools for reducing corruption, for exposing corruption within the government. There obviously are many things a Russian government could do if they were serious about this. And I think, you know, that was put to them very bluntly at this meeting last week.
Generally speaking, you're talking in this dialogue about human rights issues, right?
Yeah, and again, the role that civil society can play to make better public policy. We're trying to move towards the idea that instead of thinking of civil society as always antagonistic and anti-government, we can demonstrate through our historical experiences that civil society can play a positive role in advancing, you know, actual policies that the government wants. And we also talked about the role of civil society in the past and at times in present day, also having to be more confrontational, more antagonistic towards the government, and that's part of the, you know, of all democracies.
Do you feel that these discussions in the 2 years that they've been going on now have had a beneficial effect on the human rights situation in Russia?
Positive, I think the judges of that have to be the leaders of civil society in Russia. That's not for me to judge, frankly. I know their criticism. I listen to their criticism. I respect their criticism. We've tried to react to it. Our attitude is we can engage in dialogue and disagreement, by the way. We engage in a lot of disagreement. That doesn't mean because of our willingness to talk to people about issues that we disagree, we don't think that constrains what we do in other spheres, what we do in our engagement with civil society leaders outside of the confines of this, you know, this very small interaction that we have with the Russian government. After all, this group's only met 3 times in 2 years. I meet every day with Russian civil society, including today, as they come through town and as I travel in Russia. So it's just one of many things that we do. And whether or not any of our programs and any of our initiatives under the Obama administration have had any positive impact, I think the judges of that have to be civil society leaders in Russia.
That was Michael McFaul, U.S. President Obama's top advisor on Russia, speaking to our chief Washington editor, Christian Carl, about the U.S.-Russian human rights dialogue. Coming up next, an Uzbek cab driver entertains his customers by singing songs in his native language. If you catch a cab ride in Chicago these days, you may get lucky and get your driver to sing for you. A young cab driver of increasing fame, who goes by the name of Mr. Nematilo, is known to serenade his customers in his native Uzbek. An ethnic Uzbek, Mr. Nematilo comes from the city of Osh in southern Kyrgyzstan. He studied business in Osh, and while he plans to continue studies in America, he has found a creative way to make himself known to the world. He records many of his performances and posts the videos to his YouTube channel. Our intern, Joanna Kinsherf, got in touch with the singing cabbie, and here's what he had to say.
Your YouTube channel's gotten a lot of views and comments lately. I guess you've gotten very popular. Can you tell us how this all got started?
Well, it's not a secret that I drive a taxi in Chicago, and this is a very tough job, very difficult sometimes, very stressful, sometimes interesting, but I get bored a lot. I wanted to do something to entertain myself. I was singing before without recording, and then I recorded myself on my iPhone, and then it sounded good for me, and then I had an idea, why don't I put this to the YouTube, so other friends of mine in the United States could see me, and if they like or not, I wanted to know. And then when I first sang, that happened to be with the customer. And then I asked my customer, hey, I was going to sing, you don't mind? And then he saying, hey, you're cool, yeah, go ahead. I didn't expect any good results, but it worked out. And
yeah, you've gotten a lot of positive feedback.
After the first video, like, I got a lot of good comments, people saying, hey, we really like your video. Then I got inspired, then decide to put more and more videos.
You're from Osh, right?
I'm from Osh, yeah, Kyrgyzstan, yeah.
Is your family all still there?
My family is back home, yeah. I'm just myself in the U.S.
What are some passengers' reactions when you sing songs, especially in Uzbek, which they might not be familiar with that culture?
Whomever I sang in my taxi, all of them really, really liked that. And then they asked me, hey, I got to have this music. What language is that? And then I proudly said, like, I'm Uzbek. And that's sweet language, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Americans here really love my language, which is Uzbek. And it's sweet, beautiful language.
Do you have any future plans?
I'm going to school in Chicago for the Northeastern University from coming fall, which is going to be a business school. I've got already a bachelor's degree from back home, but my longer term is probably I might go back to home country and help my people. This is what I dream about. Show business, well, I'm kind of thinking about it. I'm not sure whether I'm good or not. But I got offers from Florida, New York, California, like Uzbeks who write the music. They invited me to make my own music in the U.S.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us.
No problem, my pleasure.
That was Joanna Kinsherf speaking to Mr. Nematilo, an Uzbek cab driver in Chicago. This is all I have for you this week. Thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To find out more about these and other stories, go to our website at rferl.org. Please send your comments to podcasts@rferl.org or leave your feedback on the podcast page on our website. And now I'll leave you with the music of Mr. Nematilo, the singing cab driver in Chicago. I'm Pavel Butorin. Take care. Siz faqat meniki, o'zim.